Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, committed to excellent service and friendly smiles. Your food is our passion.
The science writer Edward Dolnick says for scientists and for pretty much everyone else in Western civilization in the early part of the 19th century, the natural world was an orderly place, designed by a benevolent creator or an ingenious clockmaker. All the creatures and plants had a purpose, and we humans were positioned front and center. But then things started to shift. In the spring of 1802, a 12-year-old farm boy was plowing his father's field in South Hadley, Massachusetts. Dolnick says the kid had a great name, Pliny Moody.
It sounds like a grand and imposing fellow, but he's not. And he's working for his father, plowing the field. And as he's plowing, the plow has turned up something strange in the dirt. And he hops down to see what it is, and he scrapes away a bit of dirt and muck. And what he sees is a big slab of stone. And in that stone, there are about a dozen tracks, footprints it looks like. Each one is about the size of a dinner plate. They're in a row. They have three toes, it looks like. He's never seen anything like this. No one, in fact, has ever seen anything like this, and no one knows what to make of it. He managed to dig it up and haul it home, and there he showed everyone. And so the locals in town had their best guesses, and the reverend in town. There was a geology professor not terribly far away. Someone summoned him to have a look at it. Maybe these were some kind of biblical bird, some enormous bird from the ancient past. That was the best anyone could come up with. It was decades and decades before the mystery was solved of what it was that this farm boy, Pliny Moody, had found. It turned out that these were the first dinosaur tracks ever turned up. But no one had ever, at that time, had any idea that they were dinosaur tracks. No one had ever heard of dinosaurs. No one had ever imagined that there had once been such things. As far as anyone knew, the animals in the world were the ones we know from Noah's Ark. But this was something bizarrely different than that, and no one knew what it could possibly be. So this is the early 1800s. Darwin hasn't come along yet. And the picture that people have of the world was that it had always looked more or less the way it looked to them. There were oak trees and elm trees, that kind of thing, sheep and horses and cows. But the notion that there had once been lizards bigger than elephants, say, no one had imagined that. Not Leonardo da Vinci, not Shakespeare. And hardly anyone at this point knew that the Earth was ancient. Nowadays, we put the age of the Earth at billions of years. But in this era, people talked about thousands of years. And even that struck them as awfully old. People didn't think, oh, the Earth is 6,000 years old. That's hardly any time at all. They thought, the Earth is 6,000 years old. That's virtually eternal. The notion of God was that he was a meticulous craftsman, a loving creator, who had essentially fashioned the world as a kind of diorama. He had put plants and trees and bushes in place, each one with loving and meticulous care. He'd drawn the stripes on the zebra. He'd put the feathers in the peacock's tail. He was an impeccable craftsman with an eye for detail, with endless patience. And each feature of the world represented a design that he had carried out himself. What was important about that find, and it was soon followed by all kinds of dinosaur finds, was that the world contained surprises that were something that the people of this era had no notion how to incorporate into their worldview. It was as startling for them as it would be for us if we found proof that there really were aliens, that they had come to Earth. These signs of early life that people found in the 1800s were things that you couldn't deny. It was a tooth bigger than a man's hand, a rib that stood as tall as a person did. This was very strange, and it wasn't something that you could dismiss as a dream or a myth.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Edward Dolnick is with us for the hour. His latest book is called Dinosaurs at the Dinner Party. It's about how the discovery of those footprints and then bones and then whole skeletons forced scientists and believers to rethink their notions of the past and the order of the universe. As Dolnick puts it, they had to make sense of eons of time when the Bible fit all of creation into a mere 6 days. Once Pliny had found the footprints, Dolnick says the dinosaur discoveries came in a rush, and it had to be disorienting. In fact, he told us, this is the part that first interested him in the story.
What intrigued me at first was, what would it be like to think, to see for the first time an idea that had never occurred to anyone, and to have this idea thrust at you in some way that you couldn't deny? Here was something that you had to find a way to make sense of. And so the spectacle of the story, what intrigued me, was you had the smartest people in the world who were knocking their heads against a wall trying to solve a riddle that today a six-year-old could have helped them out with.
You say that this dinosaur story stands apart from other scientific mysteries in the sense that it's really unusual, of course, but it also is best approached, as you say, in an unusual way. And I wanted to ask you what you mean by that, because you say it's kind of like a detective story, but you don't begin with a body. You begin with just pieces, and you have to kind of imagine a body. Say more about that.
Well, what was so strange was that, as you say, it is akin to a detective story, but in a typical detective story, the opening scene is someone is walking in a park and the dog starts sniffing in the bushes, and then you yell at the dog a minute, and then you give in and go to see what's over there. And there, oh my God, it's a corpse. It's someone who's been stabbed, and you gather the evidence. This was like that, in that people unexpectedly stumbled on something they had no idea about finding. But what they found was only bits and pieces of something strange, and you had to ask, where did this come from? How had it come to be? And very quickly you would rule out any easy explanation. It wasn't from an animal that had wandered and died. It wasn't from any kind of creature that you had ever seen or that anyone had ever written about in a book. There was something new going on here, and so you first had to figure out how these tiny bits of evidence could possibly fit together, and then what in the world could explain them?
Well, it's also interesting that these detectives, in order to work this out, they had to rethink the order of the world, the nature of God, where humans fit into a larger picture. Even the idea of extinction, which we'll dig into here in a moment, those were not assumptions at that moment. So they had to they had that going against them too, it seems.
These were terribly smart people whose worldview had no place for the kind of riddle that these dinosaur bones forced you to confront. As you say, for instance, extinction was a giant question, because whatever these bones were from, it seemed like those creatures weren't still around, because they were awfully big and no one had bumped into them. But that means that they were here once and now they weren't around anymore. And for us, that wouldn't be a surprise. We would say, well, they must have gone extinct. But no one had ever imagined that idea either, the idea of extinction, because the idea was that every living creature on the world, as we say, had been placed in its setting by God. It was a choice. And now to say that choice, something had gone wrong, that animal had been written out of existence, meant that God had second thoughts, and no one could imagine how that could be. What did that mean? God was, by definition, a perfect creator, and here were some of his creations that evidently he had tired of. And what did that mean? And if he had got tired of them, could it be that he would someday get tired of us? And that was, in the 1800s a terrifying and unsettling thought.
One of the things I liked this that you do in the book, because it's hard to imagine them conceiving of something new like that. So what you say is to readers is try and imagine a modern counterpart. Say a little bit more about that, because it helped get me thinking differently. I'm trying to imagine what the world would have been like and how they would have thought about it then. Say a little bit more about that.
Well, the closest we can come, I think, is aliens. Aliens that you couldn't talk away. And so if we, with our understanding of the way the world works, suddenly looked out one day and there above downtown was a hovering spaceship, and not just flitting in and out, but staying and moving in this slow and stately way so that everyone could have a good look at it, that would raise enormous questions about where it had come from and why it had come here, and had it always been here, and how was it that we hadn't seen it before, and what did it mean? These dinosaur bones raised all kinds of questions like that for people in the 1800s. This wasn't another scientific discovery, as if an astronomer had said I'd found a new star or a new planet. This was something that had to do with the living world, in the living world right here. And they thought that they had understood the living world because we were the point. We were God's favorite. Everything was set in place for our benefit. And now here was something that seemed to have nothing at all to do with us. And so that raised enormous far-ranging questions, as aliens would do for us.
There's an important part of the book I wanted to mention, and that is the characters that we meet along the way. One of the things you've said is that the people who discovered these dinosaurs were as odd or as strange as the dinosaurs themselves. A really interesting group of eccentric and interesting, put it that way, people, I guess. That must have been part of the thing that was fun about telling the story.
Yeah, if you're going to write a book, my books take me a couple of years. And so one of the things you really want is you're going to be bumping into these people. They're going to be showing up for breakfast for those couple of years. They're going to be popping into your study all the time. You have to be glad when they turn up. And so by good fortune, these scientists were not as larger than life as dinosaurs, but they were big and quirky and formidable and opinionated. They were fun to deal with.
Well, let's talk about the first one you introduced us to, or one of the first anyway. This is a woman named Mary Anning. She, as you say, becomes the most accomplished fossil finder really of her time. And it's an interesting story. Mention that she well, you say she had three strikes against her. Let's talk about where she fits in the social order of England at the time.
So Mary Anning, who was the first great fossil finder, she was an English woman. She lived on the southern coast of England near the English Channel. She was poor, she was uneducated, and she was female. For a scientist in that era, just as you say, those were three considerable strikes. Science was kind of a gentleman's profession, or maybe even a hobby. If you had the money to have considerable spare time, you might poke around in the cliffs and look for odd rocks or ferns or that sort of thing as a hobby. What Mary Anning was doing, she lived in a town where people came for the summer. Today it's a resort town, and then it was just becoming a holiday town. She tried to scrape out a living by selling these strange little seashells or fossils, although nobody quite knew what they were, that she had found along the beach where she lived in a town called Lyme Regis. She would find a striking seashell or a funny tooth-looking thing and try to sell it to a tourist for a little bit. And she was good at that. She had a good eye. And if you would see something poking its way out of a rocky ledge or out of a cliffside, she had a kind of instinct for there might be something there and digging away at it. And she, when she was only 12, she and her brother found this enormous creature, kind of like an oversized dolphin, No one had ever seen a skeleton like this. No one knew what it was. Today, it's famous. It's in the British Museum in London. But Mary Anning found it not because she was especially interested in science, although she grew interested in science because she had such a skill at finding these fossils. But first, she dug them up to earn a living. She would sell them to collectors, the best ones, the best specimens. The collectors themselves would then donate to a museum, and the museum would proudly put this shell or this fossil or this skeleton on display. They would put the name of the collector next to this prize of their collection. They would never put Mary Anning's name there. That didn't happen for decades and decades.
Did Mary feel any personal conflict at all? As you say, she was a simple woman. She was uneducated. She struggled throughout her life. Deeply devout, though. And I wonder, did she ever feel any personal conflict about those fossils that she was finding and her religious commitments?
She was terribly religious. She managed to think of these fossils, of her finds, in a way that reinforced her own religious beliefs. She took them to be natural marvels, which was, she didn't quite know, she didn't presume to read God's mind. Who would be so presumptuous? But nonetheless, these were gorgeous, glorious facts in the natural world created by God. And what that showed was that God was all the more stupendous, all the more marvelous than we had ever known, because we admired him already when we only knew some of his handiwork. Now here was still more, and look at how respectful, how awed we have to be by God's craft. That was how she looked at it herself. Other people had their faith shaken by her finds, although, as I say, she did it. For them, since there was plainly no mention in the Bible of these enormous lumbering beasts, they took Mary's finds to be a contradiction of Scripture, and therefore to cast their religious beliefs in question. And so they were hostile to these discoveries. But Mary herself was able to reconcile them, as I say, by taking them as evidence of God's imagination and God's craft.
Edward Dolnick, his book is Dinosaurs at the Dinner Party: How an Eccentric Group of Victorians Discovered Prehistoric Creatures and Accidentally Upended the World. We'll take a break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, committed to excellent service and friendly smiles. Your food is our passion.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the moments when the first dinosaur footprints and bones were discovered. Most everyone in the 19th century believed the world had always looked the same, with the same plants and creatures. The science writer Edward Dolnick has a book about these people who pieced together this new understanding of human history and really threw people for a loop. The book is called Dinosaurs at the Dinner Party. Well, this idea of religion is an important part of the story, because you say that the Victorians were, I think this is how you put it, serious about their science, but they were also very serious about their religious beliefs. Let's talk about the kind of vision that a lot of religious people had, because you talk about the way that their vision of where they fit in God's ordered universe would change just slowly. I'll use a pun here, evolved over time. Start with maybe William Paley, a man named William Paley. He had this vision of God's intent for the world to be not, you know, brutish and short, but a happy world. Talk about that initial sense, that vision of the time.
William Paley was a terribly important English thinker around 1800. He was a philosopher, a theologian, a good writer, mandatory. He turned out lots of books, and they were on every reading list. When Charles Darwin went to the university, he said that the best thing he ever read was William Paley explaining how the natural world worked. And Paley who was deeply, deeply devout, Paley's vision was that the world was a happy place. That was the phrase he used. You can imagine the birds chirping, and he looked at a brook, and he said that you can see the fish cavorting. He said they're so happy they could scarcely contain themselves. Everything was happy and cheery. This was the era of all things bright and beautiful. The notion was that the living world was this marvelous rainbow of design, of perfect order. There were things like a lion eating an antelope, that kind of thing, which you wouldn't picture was very happy for the antelope. But Paley wasn't fazed even by things like that, that yes, there had to be death in the world, because otherwise there would be no room for new life, and that would defeat the whole purpose of creation. But though there was death, it was quick and it was painless, Paley said. So it's not that the lion torments the antelope, but with its great swipe of its mighty paw, it quickly dispatches it. Not only was this true of the natural world, the birds and bees and horses and ducks, but we were part of that world too, and we were at the peak of creation. The world was a kind of pyramid with worms and slugs at the base of that pyramid, and then seashells and snails and things like that a bit higher, and then snakes and reptiles, and then mammals, and at the top, us. Everything is for humankind's benefit. And so for Paley and all the vast number of his followers, the dinosaur discovery called all that into question. What was the point of these things? They didn't seem so happy, so beautiful. Their great teeth and their lumbering, slithering, slimy bodies, or at least that's what people guessed they had looked like. So dinosaurs came along and they clashed with the prevailing worldview, this happy view that Paley had put forth and that everyone had endorsed. All of a sudden, that cozy picture wasn't so cozy anymore when all these strange bones started turning up.
Yeah, you write that in a world where God had painted every stripe on every zebra, where did dinosaurs fit? Like, what were they for? And say a little bit more about the way people began to imagine what were they for, where they might have come from. One of the things you mention is there was this belief in the 19th century that they could be emissaries from another world, that maybe they were aliens made flesh. What were some of the theories that start to develop?
Well, you had to think very hard to explain these dinosaurs, because there were a couple of things going on at once. Everyone in England, nearly everyone, is deeply religious. So that's an important thing. But then, as we've said, these dinosaurs come along and they call those religious views into question, or at least you're going to have to fiddle with them a bit to make sense of them. And so that's the first task. The believers, like Paley, are serious, so they don't want to deny the science. But on the other hand, they can't possibly say our religious beliefs have it wrong. And so they tried to come up with a way to reconcile the science and the religion. And this was an era, this wasn't like Galileo in the Inquisition. This was an era when people believed that science and religion were not in conflict. They fit together. The way they fit was in Mary Anning's way of thinking. They fit because the glories, the wonders of creation, the variety of creation, testify to God's infinite talent in devotion to the natural world. And so what people said was, well, it looked like these dinosaurs lived a long time ago. And that's a strange thing, because the Bible talks about on the first day and on the second day. It doesn't talk about the first era or millions or billions of years ago. And they said, oh, but that's okay, because when the Bible talks about things like days, it doesn't mean a literal day, the 24-hour day that we talk about when we say, I'll meet you tomorrow. They said, when the Bible talks about days, that was a kind of metaphoric day, like when an old man says, in my day, we didn't have the internet. He doesn't mean a specific day. He means back when, once upon a time. And so these dinosaurs, they said, lived in an earlier day, but that doesn't contradict the Bible. Mm-hmm. That the Bible was written in a way so that ordinary people could understand it. So it's not a contradiction, they said, that these dinosaurs lived a long time ago, and the Bible doesn't talk about the world as extending a long time ago. Because if you interpret the Bible correctly, they said, it really did make room for the ancient past. And dinosaurs, they said, well, it seems strange because they weren't on Noah's Ark. You didn't have stegosauruses marching up the ramp two by two. But they said that's okay because the moral significance of the Bible stories starts when humans come on the scene. Mm-hmm. So it's okay if there was a kind of prehistory with these strange creatures. And so things are okay. Because for early scientists, it was a big mystery. The dinosaurs lived a long time ago, and then we came along only relatively recently, the scientists said. And that was a big problem for them. To have had the dinosaurs carrying on for ages before humans didn't make sense. It would be like putting on a play in an empty theater, they said. But now they were able to rationalize that by this business of the opening acts. We're all fine, but they don't really count because the show starts when the humans turn up.
Well, you also write about how we go from Paley's idea of the world being this happy place to maybe not such a happy place. And science is breaking down these old ideas of, you know, man's dominion and God's sense of order. And one of the ways that they reconciled religion with, you know, these new ideas of the world that you write about, that I wanted to ask you about, I found really interesting, was through poetry. Alfred Lord Tennyson, who does not abandon his belief in God, that wouldn't have been possible at the time necessarily. But he did ask these new questions about God's role in the universe. Talk about Tennyson. That this was really interesting.
One of the differences between the Victorian age and ours is that the intellectuals weren't as compartmentalized then as they are today. Yeah. So in that era, if you knew a lot about literature and art, say, it was also taken for granted that you might very well be terribly interested in science and the natural world. Those things went together. Tennyson, who was poet laureate in Victorian England, was terribly interested in science. He wrote a diary where he set aside Monday for chemistry and Tuesday for physics and Wednesday for biology, this kind of thing. He self-taught. But these dinosaurs really threw him into a tizzy because he was deeply religious, and another one of these people, as I say, who was deeply concerned with science too, and not with trying to hide new discoveries under the rug. So when he learned about fossils, say, or learned that that the world was so ancient that mountains could wear away bit by bit, and so a towering mountain would eventually become a mere hill, and then maybe a valley, that kind of thing. That time scale, instead of trying to talk it away, he wrote these marvelous poems that people still read today about the hills melting like shadows, things like that. And so he's trying over the years to reconcile his scientific beliefs and his religious ones. He does it in poetry because that's how he thinks, that's how he works. But he's serious, and so he has to face ever new challenges. He says he's trying to write about this happy world, and if he really believes in it, and he says, well, maybe not, because you see these fossils, and these are bygone creatures, but maybe they were just individuals who somehow ran afoul of the great cosmic order. Mm-hmm. But then more and more fossils turn up. And he says, no, I was wrong. It wasn't just that one or two creatures met an unfortunate end. There's whole species wiped out. There's whole eras that we have no record of now, or only this passing records of bits and pieces, of fragments of bone. So how could that be? And so he writes these anguished, heartfelt poems. Tennyson wrote a line about nature red in tooth and claw. He said,
yeah.
This was a violent world. What about Paley? He'd grown up, Tennyson had, believing in this kind, peaceful world with the birds chirping. But now, red in tooth and claw, that means that this death and mayhem are built in from the start. How can that be?
Mm. So this idea of where we fit starts to change. As you say in the book, he's raising these questions about whether is life sacred or even significant. We're humans, as you put it, destined for oblivion, just like all the other, you know, fossils.
One of the scary notions for Tennyson, first he says there are all these signs of death around us. That's what the fossils are. These are creatures that lived and then died. But maybe that makes sense. Maybe there was some kind of punishment. Maybe they did something wrong, and therefore, although it's a sad story, at least it's a story that makes sense. But then as more and more fossils turn up and all sorts of creatures in all sorts of places, he thinks, well, maybe that notion that God had a beef with these particular creatures, that doesn't seem to hold up. Maybe he just didn't care. Maybe he had turned his back on part of his creation and part of it died out. And for him, that notion of an indifferent God is even more scary than the notion of an angry God. Because if there was an angry God, you could try to understand his wrath, or how can you placate him, or how could you become a better person? What should you do different? But if he's simply indifferent, if for some reason his creation no longer holds a special place, that was a terrifying possibility. Mm. This was a kind of existentialism a century or two before there was such a philosophy. What if there is no meaning? That was a brand new and frightening question.
The idea of extinction brings all that up, of course. And I wanted to ask you about another one of the great characters in the book, Georges Cuvier. Would you talk about – you describe him – we talk a little bit about in the book. You talk a little bit about the sort of span of his life. But early on, you describe him as this young man in a hurry. And there's this lecture that he delivers early on in his life, April of 1796, I think it is. And he wants to demonstrate this revolutionary, for the time, concept that extinction was a fact. Talk about this and the idea that he is determined to describe to the world.
As we've said, extinction was a giant slap in the face, because it meant that God's plan seemed to have this built into it, this frightening end of story feature. People had always known that an individual could die. It could be that your grandparent or your neighbor would die, but nobody had any notion that a species could die. For the reasons we say, that God had created the species, and so what would it mean? Cuvier, who was a great intellectual in this same era we've been talking about, around 1800, was French, and he's young, and he's by no means an establishment figure like the English scientists are. And so he's happy to make trouble. And one of the things he says, he's the great expert early on ancient bones. He knows more than anyone else does about anatomy and paleontology. And he gives a talk about some bones he's found. These are woolly mammoths. He looks at elephant bones, and he looks at mammoth bones, which are related to them. And he looks at there are different kinds of elephants. There's Asian elephants today and African elephants. And he proves that these are different species, the Asian from the African, from the mammoths, in fact. And he says, and he lays out the evidence so that there's no dispute about it. Not only are these kinds of elephants different from one another, But the woolly mammoths, they don't exist anymore. Yeah. Extinction is a fact, he says. I've got the evidence. Here it is. Here's a bone from something that once walked the earth and that no longer does. Maybe extinction makes trouble for you religious believers, Cuvier says, in effect. But tough. You're going to have to learn to live with it, because I've just proved that extinction is a fact. You can't talk it away. And now people have to try to make sense of it.
Edward Dolnick. His book is Dinosaurs at the Dinner Party, How an Eccentric Group of Victorians Discovered Prehistoric Creatures and Accidentally Upended the World. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for Radio West comes from listeners like you. Become a member at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with the writer Edward Dolnick. We're talking about his book, Dinosaurs at the Dinner Party. Let's talk about another one of the great characters in the story. There's this another twist in the tale here where dinosaurs would be enlisted in this intellectual battle that's playing out, of course, the emerging doctrine of evolution. And it gets us to Richard Owen. Tell us about Richard Owen. You describe him as a very complicated man. Sounds like something of a kind of a pompous jerk, probably too. But tell us about him and where he fits.
That's certainly one side of it. He was evidently really hard to take. One of his contemporaries said that one reason that he was so hard to take was that he was not only a man of tremendous talents, but made a point of making sure that you understood that as well as he did. Right. A tremendous track record, a really brilliant fellow. He was the successor to Cuvier, essentially, as the great expert on ancient bones. Cuvier was French. Owen is English. By a fortune of historical casting or something, he looked a bit like one of the fossils he was always studying. He was right. Was tall and bony, skinny like Ichabod Crane. So a very, very off-putting personal manner. But brilliant as well. He's important in our story because it's Owen who's the fellow who in the 1840s actually coins the word dinosaur. He says there were all kinds of ancient creatures. I've been studying them, and some of them have special properties in common, and I'm going to give a new name for them. I'm going to call these things dinosaurs. It's from a Greek word. It means terrible lizard, terrible in the sense of terrifying. The Lord is great and terrible, that kind of terrible. So these imposing, awesome creatures. But Owen is religious too. So how is he going to make sense of these awesome, terrifying creatures that aren't mentioned in the Bible? And what he does, this is before Darwin, as I say. Mm-hmm. So when Darwin comes along, Darwin is going to talk about evolution and natural selection, that sort of thing, survival of the fittest. But even before Darwin, people believed in a form of evolution. It was quite contrary to the way Darwin would set it up later. But what they believed, what they meant by evolution, what Owen meant by evolution, was a kind of natural unfolding of progress of life. That life starts out in this view with lowly creatures like snails and bugs and works its way up through ever more complicated and grand creatures, and finally culminates in us. That kind of unfolding was what people meant by evolution. But Owen is very suspicious of this whole thing, all this talk of unfolding and progress, because he's found these dinosaurs, and the dinosaurs come along very early in the story. Yeah. So if the story of life is evolution and unfolding and going from tiny and lowly to big and marvelous, how come you had these big, fearsome things at the beginning of the story? Well, Owen's perfectly happy with that because he says, I told you these people talking about evolution were all wet. And see, they're wrong because early on you have sophisticated animals, big, complicated right. ones. And therefore, evolution has it all wrong. And you have to believe not in life unrolling by itself, but in God creating life just as he chooses, according to a divine plan. So Owen not only comes up with this idea of dinosaurs, but he uses it in a kind of political way to show that I'm right. My view of life as created specially by God according to his plan and not unfolding in some mechanical way. Owen says, my view was right all along. Down with evolution, up with dinosaurs, up with me. Haven't I outsmarted everyone?
It's interesting. The I guess the important part of the story is this idea of rules, that God set up these natural rules. So what Owen is saying is this wasn't chance. God set up the blueprint at the beginning of time. He sort of, I think you said he came to believe that God seeded the world with these species, set up the ground rules, then sort of sat back to see it play out.
Owen's notion was that he devoutly believed in God, and he was trying to explain the same riddles that Darwin would explain a few years later.
Yeah.
Why is it that if you look at the bones in a whale's flipper and the bones in a person's hand, say, there's the same five of them and the bones are arranged in the same way? Why, if you look at the skeleton of a horse and the skeleton of a cow, is there some resemblance? What Darwin would come along and say later on is the reason you see that kind of resemblance is because life has a history in what you're looking at and trying to explain, Darwin says, will turn out to be a family resemblance. Members of a family who are closely related will have structures that are closely related, and distant relatives will be more distant. Owen had a different theory. What Owen says is God is a master designer. And the reason you see over and over again these hands and flippers and paws with five bones in them isn't because of some kind of descent or family resemblance. It's because God is an artist. And this is one of his favorite designs. And artists, we all know, he says, tend to return again and again to their favorite themes. We see these patterns repeated, Owen says, but it's not anything to do with something of a family background. It's to do with the favorite touches of a divine creator.
So Owen figures he had figured out this greatest mystery of the age. This brings us to this incredible New Year's Eve party in 1853, which is kind of the bookend to your story. We begin with Pliny Moody's great discovery of those footprints, but then the story kind of ends here in many ways. Tell us about the party.
Richard Owen and his fellow scientists in 1853 are really thrilled with themselves. They've made these marvelous dinosaur discoveries, and those discoveries, if you look at them the right way, have reinforced the conventional worldview about humans at the peak of creation and other creatures leading their way up to it. And so they have this New Year's Eve of 1853 in London. They have this marvelous dinner to celebrate the triumph of scientists and dinosaurs. It's a dinner held for the greatest and most esteemed figures in English science. The dinner is held in a cutout of a huge dinosaur. It weighs 35 tons. It has room for a couple of dozen eminent Englishmen to eat it in this cutout thing. The dinosaur has its legs and its big neck, but its back is cut away so that there can be a banquet table there. And they're sitting, these scientists, inside the dinosaur at the table while waiters stagger up a bunch of stairs to them, bringing course after course and pouring every kind of wine and champagne and brandy and after-dinner drink to these scientists who are celebrating their great discoveries. Dinner starts at 4 in the afternoon, and at midnight, at New Year's Eve, it's still going strong. And now at 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock in the morning, these diners are staggering out of the dinosaur and home to London, their arms around one another, all a little tipsy, singing these songs about farewell to the dinosaurs. That's their triumph. They discovered dinosaurs and welcomed them and made sense of them, and all is well.
Yeah, they restored order to their world. But then, as you say, a bomb went off. And, of course, the bomb maker is Charles Darwin. give us a sense of how Darwin upends that sense of order once again, because you say Darwin realized, look, there could be a design without a designer.
Yeah, Darwin comes along with that startling idea. What he figures out is a way to explain how the order that we see in the world could have come to be without God at his design board, painting every stripe on every zebra. If there was a kind of selection where the fittest survive, a critter who was well suited to his environment would edge out one who wasn't quite so well suited. And if you had vast, vast stretches of time, eventually those well-suited animals, well-suited to their environment, would come to be terribly well-suited, and they would give every evidence that they had been designed for that purpose, even though it was nature that had designed them by whittling out the slow-running or the timid or the not very good flyers in favor of their more skilled counterparts. Darwin says all this. He convinces the world, but it's a scary thought, and to this day, it's an idea that people have difficulty with. But one of the things it means is that Owen's picture of God fashioning a kind of diorama doesn't hold anymore. Scientists no longer believe that. They don't need that picture of God fashioning a kind of stage set. This story will play out by itself with nature, not God, in charge. And humans, according to Darwin, are one more kind of animal in this complicated story. They're not special. They're not set apart. We happen to have come along, but it could be, Darwin says, that if life had taken a different turn, if he didn't know about asteroids, but he would have been perfectly happy with that notion. If an asteroid had happened to hit and knock us out, we wouldn't be at the peak of the story. We wouldn't be in the story at all. So Darwin's story has chance and happenstance built into it from the get-go. Owen's story had this purposeful God at his design board. Darwin's story wins out. Owen's story is relegated to a historical footnote. And in fact, in London, there's the Natural History Museum, this great cathedral to science. It's one of the great buildings in the world, all kinds of dinosaur statues and other artifacts in it. And it was Owen who had it built. He raised the money. He had say in every feature of the design, including having a giant statue of himself placed in a place of honor as the person who figured out how the natural world worked. Well, now in the museum that he himself had built, his statue is shoved into a broom closet, and there in its place stand, as if an emblem of the story, Darwin's statue is there instead. Everyone knows Darwin's name. No one knows Owen's name. Owen is lost to history. Darwin's version of the story is the one that's taught in school.
So with Darwin, there's no going back to that old idea. But I guess the question is, maybe finally, did it go away completely? Edward Dolnick, what do you see when you see creationists and their ideas in museums where there are dioramas with humans wandering around with dinosaurs? Is there an effort there to bring back that sense of God being in control, to bring back the idea that Owen figured he would bring back?
That's still a hugely popular and hugely appealing idea, the notion that we are God's special favorites. You can see how bold it was for Darwin to come along 150 years ago, more than that now, and propose this theory, because just as you say, we don't like it now. The notion that we're not special, we are one kind of animal in a world full of animals, is one that we still do our best to resist. When Darwin came up with the theory, he wrote an outline of it years before he published. It took him a couple of decades to dare to face the wrath that he knew he would when he proposed his theory. And he wrote a letter to a friend at a point when he'd just set out all the ideas in his own mind. And he said, talking about evolution and natural selection, Darwin wrote, "It is like confessing a murder." He did come in for terrible abuse. The scientists, for the most part, conceded fairly quickly that, yes, his argument was better. He had it right. But nonetheless, all kinds of personal attacks. And as you say, all these decades later, there's still an impulse to say, oh, it can't quite be right. It must be that the story is built around us. It must be that we hold a special place in creation. It's a hard idea to dispel.
Edward Dolnick, thank you very much.
Well, I've enjoyed this. Thank you very much.
That's Edward Dolnick. His book is Dinosaurs at the Dinner Party: How an Eccentric Group of Victorians Discovered Prehistoric Creatures and Accidentally Upended the World. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And we're on YouTube at KUER90.1 and Instagram at Radio West. Our intern is Stevie Shaughnessy, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Carrie Watson is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.